Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, we don't have any wine because we're doing this earlier than normal. Why are we doing this earlier than normal? What's going on?
We are doing this earlier than normal because it is windy as heck outside, and some of us got the day off.
If you are a government employee, guess what you did today? Nothing.
That is ridiculous. The rest of us are working. I'm just taking a quick break from my work day in order to get the podcast cranked out, but it is pretty darn windy out there.
So yeah, we're doing this earlier, so no wine to make fun of tonight, but we have four films we're going to talk about, two Hollywood, two documentaries, and the first one you didn't see. And you didn't see the biggest film of the week, Madam Queen Jennifer Lawrence in Red Sparrow. You did not see Red Sparrow.
Why did I not see Red Sparrow?
Because there was one screening 2 weeks ago at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Exactly, and once again, for those of us that have to work a somewhat more full day, it gets a little trickier. Anyway, go for it.
Actually, it's like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That's why I saw it. It's a polarizing film. People are split down the middle. Right now, it's in the 50 percentile Rotten Tomatoes. You either kind of like it or you hate it. No one really loves it. Some people really hate it. And it's based on a novel by a man named Jason Matthews. Jason Matthews was in the CIA for over 30 years. He knows what he's talking about when he's writing about espionage and spies trying to find people's weakness and work their way in and steal secrets. He knows what he's talking about. And apparently this is a very popular novel, a bestseller, and it's set mostly in Moscow. And Jennifer Lawrence is playing a Russian with a thick English, Rush, you know, she's supposed to be Russian, but she's speaking in this English accented, you know, she talks like this. And, you know,
like Natasha.
I wish it was in Russian, but, you know, apparently Hollywood's in the business of making money. So it's all in English. And she needs to steal secrets from Joel Edgerton. He is a, he's actually Australian playing an American. Easier kind of average Joe. Nate Nash is his name. She needs to steal an identity of Nate Nash's source, a source way high up in the Russian government, and she needs to get trained how to do that. Jennifer Lawrence's character, Dominika, is a ballerina, a prima ballerina, at the Bolshoi, and after a very gruesome ballet accident, I didn't know they had ballet accidents, but she has a ballet accident, and it is disgusting. She has no choice but to go to Sparrow School and learn how really to use her body to get information. This is what splits the audience down the middle. I believe it. You know, Russian, especially Soviet agents back in the day, were expected to use certain skills, certain assets to work their way in and get secrets. So she, as she calls it, you sent me to whore school, which is taking over pop culture right now, that quote. You sent me to whore school.
Okay, so hold on, back up a minute. So I'm totally confused. So this is essentially a Russian movie. Like, it's supposed to be in Russia, and it's a Russian movie. It just happens to be that you've got this American and Australian playing these Russians.
Mm. Well, okay. He's American. He's a CIA operator.
Right, but it's an Australian guy playing that
yeah,
American.
Yeah, he's got the twangiest American accent
ever.
So
this is why it really is, which should be, a Russian film in Russian with English subtitles.
It should be.
Okay.
But it's not.
All right. But that I was really confused as to exactly what this film was supposed to be about and where it was supposed to be set and why.
Jeremy Irons, Mr. I don't know, is he? I guess he's American. But he could come off British if he wanted
to.
I thought he was American.
I don't know. We'll have to look that up.
He plays a Russian general. He doesn't really try the thick accent that Jennifer Lawrence does. But Jennifer Lawrence, remember Atomic Blonde, where... what was her name?
Charlize Theron. Yeah,
just got the crap knocked out of her, just beaten to a pulp. Jennifer Lawrence has that happen to her as well. There's kind of, you know, a lot of people are saying there's a recent trend of just female humiliation, female submission, because she gets stripped a lot. She gets naked. She's in her underwear a lot. She gets raped. She gets attempted raped, and. But by the end, maybe there's an aspect of empowerment where she turns the tables. So that's the biggest polarization. It's not that the plot is predictable, which it is. It's not that it's dull and plotting, which it can be. This is not Atomic Blonde. This is not action. This is talking and trying to gain trust and thinking. But what splits the audience down the middle are those scenes, those frequent subjugation, being dominated scenes. People find that tough to watch, but Jennifer Lawrence says, hey, you saw the 60 Minutes interview I did. Mm-hmm. What did she say?
She said, I believe, hopefully I'm maybe paraphrasing a bit, but she says, if you don't like boobs, don't go see Red Sparrow.
And it's kind of reductive because, you know, yeah, there are Jennifer Lawrence boobs in this, but it's more if you don't like severe violence inflicted upon females in an unwilling manner.
And the same people who are going to judge the folks who went to see 50 Shades are going to be okay with this one.
I see what you're saying there.
Yeah, come on. At least that one's like a romantic fairy tale in the end. This just sounds horrifying to watch.
But I did not find this dull. I was leaning forward in my seat. It's like, because you're being deceived. You don't know who's lying. Everyone's probably lying. Maybe someone's telling the truth. And you're trying to figure it out. How is someone spinning this right now? Who's deceiving whom? And it's such a mind game. And at the end, I guessed it so early. And that kind of made me mad. It's like, oh, this is it right here. I guarantee you. And it turned out I was right. But it's, you know, it's a big mystery. If you don't figure it out, maybe you'd be like, oh, snap. But
I probably would have survived it because I like Jennifer Lawrence. I like Joel Edgerton. I like Jeremy Irons. And so it's got this really solid cast. But the premise of this film and the style of this film, it just is not anything that I really care to see.
Well, you also wouldn't have liked the running time. It's like 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Then it's even more so. I put it in that
But it
category.
Turns out I'm in the slight minority. I liked it.
Some of our colleagues who saw it, they've liked it too. And so I do believe that Jennifer Lawrence can carry a film. I mean, she's just very watchable. And so I think if you're going to have a movie that might be polarizing, that might not otherwise appeal to people, having lead actors that are appealing can only help it.
Well, I guess the director knows how to get a performance from Jennifer Lawrence. It's Francis Lawrence. They are not related, but he directed 3 out of the 4 Hunger Games. He didn't do the first one, but he did the last 3. So that's Red Sparrow. I'm all for it.
All right. I don't feel like I need to catch up on this one. It's just not my thing. But I do know that I generally have always liked Jennifer Lawrence's performances. So, except for Mother. I never did see Mother either. So,
yeah, I'm very good on Jennifer Lawrence for taking bold choices recently with her film roles.
Yeah, all right. Or go back and see Winter's Bone. That was my favorite.
That might be my favorite Lawrence performance as well. That's probably my favorite film of hers.
There you go.
Now, our next film is also polarizing, but more in a timing fashion. Hannah, why is the remake of Death Wish probably being released on the worst weekend it could ever possibly be released?
It is terrible timing. From the first frame of this movie, I just thought this is not a good time. And it is. It should not be out right now because it gives completely the wrong message in terms of gun control and gun violence. And so here, when the country is finally inching somewhere, moving in the right direction, I would hope, in terms of gun control, this movie is an NRA person's dream. Anybody who's like really favors vigilante killings and guns is going to like this movie. And to me, that's a real big problem right now.
Death Wish has a firearm fetish. So Eli Roth, director Eli Roth, he heard the propaganda phrase, the only thing that will stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And he made a movie out of it, is kind of his message.
He remade
here.
A movie out
he
of it.
He remade a 1974 Charles Bronson film called Death Wish, and it's still called Death Wish. And it was one of those early Dino De Laurentiis films. And a lot of people don't know who Charles Bronson is anymore. Really, anyone under 40 probably is a little
unfamiliar.
Because
I do remember Charles Bronson.
But you don't need to see the original to get the gist, to understand what is going on. Mm-hmm. And one of my biggest problems is believability. Yeah. I do not believe for a second Bruce Willis is a trauma surgeon. Dr. Bruce Willis. No, did you? How were you on that?
What was so strange is when this film began, everyone kind of chuckled at the opening dialogue with him because you almost felt that it was mocking this character. Like, it wasn't real. Like, you were supposed to kind of not believe him as a surgeon. And so the whole movie, I really don't. It just doesn't fit. It doesn't feel right. And his delivery was just not doctorish. I don't know. I had a problem with that too. And so for him to be playing this doctor surgeon who's supposed to, you know, stick to the do no harm creed, suddenly to turn into this like killing machine is what just really pushed the boundaries of plausibility for me.
Well, we all knew what was coming. The whole premise of Death Wish is that a tragedy befalls Dr. Paul Kersey, Bruce Willis, and he wants, you know, he was told to trust the process, have faith in the police, and the police just aren't getting anywhere. They have no leads, and it doesn't really look like they're actively trying to solve what happened. So he takes matters into his own hands, and it involves guns and lots of guns. This is by director Eli Roth. Eli Roth was very famous for a time, 10 to 15 years ago. He revitalized the genre of torture porn. If you remember Hostel and Hostel 2, which is the gratuitous and most grotesque violence which makes people scream, laugh, and cry all at the same time, that's torture porn. And so he's trying his hand at resurrecting, you know, somewhat of an infamous film. And he's having fun. He wants you to have fun, and he also wants you to identify with, empathize with, and root for Dr. Paul Kersey. He wants you on his side. He's like, you know what? You're right. I would do the same thing if I were in his shoes. I would go find the Mr. Ice Cream Man in broad daylight and take out Mr. Ice Cream Man.
Yeah, and really, I would, you know, sever a nerve in some poor guy and pour the most painful acid into that wound because you know that that's going to hurt. No, I mean, that's where I had a problem, though, is that I felt I wasn't rooting for him the whole time. At the beginning, I was, but then when he started doing things that I felt crossed the line so dramatically on a moral scale, he's stealing stuff from, you know, here he's using his position as this ER doctor to swipe guns from gangbangers that are coming through the ER and to swipe their hoodies so that he has a hoodie to wear every night when he goes out and he sort of turns into his alter ego. And he's swiping their cell phones. And I'm like, these are things that would have provided real clues to potentially solving a lot of other crimes if that stuff had been turned over to the police. So I just had a problem at a certain point with the with his methods, and I felt that it did not fit the character that we were supposed to believe he was. I actually found the brother to be the most redemptive and interesting character in this film. You know, he's the sort of the loser brother who's always bumming money off of his rich brother and would be the one that you would more expect to sort of live on that dark side. And he is, you know, he's the one who has just sort of an interesting arc and is one of the few to really realize what his brother is up to. So I like that character, but I just had, I was squeamish through this entire movie, just cringing with uncomfortability because I did not like the message that this movie was sending. And I was like, this is just not a good time for anyone to go and see this movie.
All right, I'm going to disagree with you. You had me until you mentioned the brother. Vincent D'Onofrio, what is he doing in this movie? His character is there when he kind of needs to be to push something along. He's very underwritten. I have no idea what his motivation is, what he's doing. Sometimes he needs money. Sometimes he's ready to pay back money. You don't know if he's... For a while there, I thought, I wonder if...
Right, but that's...
And it's so...
You're supposed to.
Now, his character is the definition of arbitrary. He didn't even need to be in there, but since he's in there, use him, and they didn't. He's just there.
I agree. I felt that that was a missed opportunity. They should have developed that brother character more because it did not all make sense and did not fit together as well as it should. So here I spotted the kernels of what I thought would be a really good character, and I wish they had done more with that and a little less with some of the other stuff.
It also tries to philosophize. So this takes place in Chicago. So you've got Mancow in the morning and Sway on their radio shows saying, this the weekend body count, 48 people were shot, Chicago has a violence problem, what do we do, caller? And then Bruce Willis hits social media. He goes viral. This is 2018, not 1974. Therefore, people get cell phone video, and they call him the Grim Reaper, and they make memes out of him, and they make GIFs out of him. And so the radio's like, is he a hero or a zero? Are you on the side of the Grim Reaper, or are you afraid of the Grim Reaper? And it's like, you know, they're trying to be deep here. They're trying to have a conversation, but it's too snarky. It's yeah. not really coming through.
No, exactly. It doesn't play out properly. And in this day and age, when there's so much concentration and focus on gun violence and on the need for gun control, I just think this is a terrible message to be sending.
All right, our first documentary we're going to talk about, probably the bigger one, it's called Bombshell, the Hedy Lamarr story. Hedy Lamarr was you'd call her a golden age actress, maybe
1930s,
40s. Yeah. She went into the 50s.
I'm not old enough, by the way, to remember Hedy Lamarr.
I'm going to raise my hand and say I do not believe I have ever seen a Hedy Lamarr film. I learned that she was the basis for a very famous cartoon character. I did not know that, but now when I see that character, I can see the resemblance. Mm-hmm. We get her backstory, we get her film career, we get the later career. What did you think of the Hedy Lamarr story?
It was rather fascinating. I mean, I'd certainly heard of Hedy Lamarr, and I recognize her photos from that golden age, and she was very stunning. I learned that, boy, you know, you can't judge a book by its cover. Here she was this bombshell of, you know, she's a beauty, but not necessarily the best actress ever. And she had this passion for inventing. And so you learn that she, on the side, really would rather have been defined by her inventions and her penchant for inventing things. And she had invented this frequency hopping technology and gotten a patent on it. And in essence, I think she was like kind of screwed out of millions, if not billions of dollars, because the military basically shelved her patent until decades later, and then suddenly pulled it out again when it had expired, and took advantage of this technology that she had helped to invent.
The documentary wants to bring across the message: you can't, back then, you couldn't be both. You couldn't be taken seriously as a scientist or inventor if you were a famous Hollywood actress or you looked as beautiful as Hedy Lamarr looked. There were a lot of gorgeous actresses back then, but we have two directors here, famous directors, Mel Brooks and Peter Bogdanovich, both say, by far, Hedy Lamarr was the most gorgeous person who ever went to Hollywood. She started in Austria. She had six marriages. She worked herself into MGM. Louis B. Mayer makes an appearance, and he doesn't see, you know, a smart woman or takes her seriously as an actress. He just puts her in horrible B movies, B roles, and she has to learn English on the fly. She has a very thick German accent in her early films, you can tell. But on the side, at night, after, you know, her shooting just horrible films and horrible roles, she invents things. Now, they introduce some controversy there. There are some people in the film say, you know, she was around, she touched on frequency hopping, but I don't think she actually invented it. I think it was the dude working with her, or she stole it from her first husband, who was a munitions guy. So some people don't believe Hedy Lamarr really truly invented frequency hopping techniques. And I don't know. The case seems kind of solid to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an interesting movie. I felt it dragged a bit in the middle, and Mel Brooks kind of just popped up now and again, and I didn't feel that his interjections really added much. She's a very complicated woman, so I think that's what I got most out of this film, is just how complex she was. And she was not the best mother or grandmother. She isolated herself. She became an addict to plastic surgery, which is ironic for someone who did not want to be defined by her looks, for her in her later years to feel this necessity to try and maintain that appearance, and it just backfired on her. And she ended up dying kind of isolated and near broke.
Yeah, it's not Alexandra Dean. She made this movie, and it's her first directorial effort, and it's well done. But Hedy Lamarr does not come across as like Joan Crawford bad, like Mommy mm-hmm. Dearest right. bad mothering. But she comes off as a neglectful, supervisor. They bring up Dr. Feelgood, the doctor to the stars that introduced everyone to meth back when that was legal. Hedy Lamarr had a sad story. She actually didn't act really after 58, 59, and you know she lived until 2000 and something maybe.
Yeah, and how this movie came about was that this Forbes magazine writer who had written something on her in like 1990, in 2016 I think it was, he rediscovered these tapes, these audio tapes with her, and from that interview that he had done. And so that's what really gives you the backbone of this film. And so you're hearing her voice. You are hearing her story being told again through the tapes that existed. And that's what makes this really work, is if I wasn't hearing her and really getting that sense of just how complicated a woman she was, then this documentary might not have – it probably never would have been made to begin with. But it's those – it's the discovery of those tapes that that really got the ball rolling on this.
Yeah, so if you're into old Hollywood or just interesting biographies, Bombshell's worth it.
Yeah, it's definitely a different take, and I learned something, that's for sure. I had no idea that Hedy Lamarr was more than a pretty face.
So sticking with Hollywood and even further behind the scenes, we saw another documentary called Actors of Sound. It's about Foley artists. And granted, I knew they existed. I kind of knew what they did. And now I find myself looking at movies in a different way. Mm-hmm. After seeing Actors of Sound, I thought microphones are so good nowadays, you record whatever happens on screen. But no, microphones still pick up voices, and you need someone to create the footsteps and the broken glass and what happens when a car falls on your brain and it spills all out all over the floor.
Or you're in an elevator and you're bashing someone's head in. What does that sound like? So that was fascinating to me. They showed how this scene from Drive, which I remember the elevator scene from Drive, where Ryan Gosling's character suddenly just simmers to this point where he then erupts and starts beating on this guy and bashing his head in. And you think that might even been off camera. And yet the sounds that you hear, you are seeing how this Foley artist created that sound using like a giant squash and just smashing the heck out of this vegetable. And you realize that all these sounds that you're hearing when you're watching these films are very often just someone's interpretation of what that would sound like. And you're buying into it and assuming that they were just amplifying the natural sound that existed. But no, these people are kind of using all sorts of interesting materials to create this illusion of what the sound would be. And it's kind of fascinating. It's not the best made documentary. It's actually kind of a shame that it wasn't better, because it could have been. It introduces way too many characters, but the idea behind it is kind of fascinating.
By far the best part of Actors of Sound are how they're making these noises. They pick some famous film, like E.T. is the big one. How did Steven Spielberg wanted, he didn't want to scare the children. So when E.T. first appears on screen, they said, make him sound funny. And they did. E.T. had a sound-defining walk, and they explained how they made that sound. And then you mentioned the character, or the Foley artist they interview. I got lost as well. They keep naming names, and you never really associate names and faces of who's doing what, and it went too fast for me. That could have been a little bit tighter edited, but it came back when they said, you know, these are the particular shoes I use for this particular walk, and this is, I go, New Jersey has the best garbage, because they go like a rummage buying, and they buy weird stuff, knickknacks, and these out-of-the-way garages and shops, and like, oh, I would use this for that. And it's like, all right, that's very interesting, because this is an overlooked art, maybe a science and an art. And they also talk about technology. People are trying to save a buck or two, cut out the human factor in Foley art, and do it all digitally. And they actually make a very strong case that you can't. You cannot. You think you could. And it, well, why can't you make footsteps on a computer? But you actually need, they convinced me, you need a human element behind this.
Yeah, it's like they're performance artists, and so they're watching the footage while they are injecting what they see to be these sounds. But I never realized that all these films use them. I always thought it was more of a fix it in post situation. We'll fix it in post. They talk briefly about the whole notion with ADR, which is this when you're adding dialogue after the fact. And so I know that when I worked on some reality shows, you would hear, we would do some ADR where you would need to get some little bit of dialogue or lines that are done after the fact, and you're putting them into, in post-production, you're adding them. And I hear it all the time now. So I can hear when something's been ADR'd, whereas the average viewer might not. And now it's the same thing. When I'm looking at, when I watch Death Wish and I watch somebody's head being bashed in, it took me to this Foley documentary, and I was thinking somebody is now going back and going, what does it sound like when you are being crushed by a vehicle, or when you are, you know, just being splattered across a driveway?
It does. It makes you think in a different way. Death Wish is also the next film I saw after Actors of Sound, and there's a part where a guy gets sliced in the face with a knife. I know a Foley guy came up with that sound, because you can't capture that on a microphone. It's not a real slice. But someone figured out how to, and he's like, you know what? That's probably what it would sound like.
So it's good and bad, because it takes you a little bit out of the moment, because you're actually realizing now that there's this whole other layer that goes on in the post-production of these films. And you wonder what the actors are always necessarily reacting to. And so it's amazing when they're able to balance what the actors' reactions in a scene are with the sounds that they create after the fact. And it's very inside baseball. They go too far with trying to bring in a lot of international elements, like here's a Foley artist in Germany, here's a Foley artist in India, and here's how it kind of lost its tracking when it did that. And so I wish they had spent a little more time on maybe a couple of specific characters, Foley artists, and really dove deeper into some of the work that they had done, and shown more of those side by side. Here's the sound we were doing, and here's the scene in the film. Those were my favorite moments.
Well, it's by a first-time feature documentary filmmaker, Lalo Molina. But I like peeking behind the curtain. Mm-hmm. I know it just, well, we're critics, so we do like to peek behind the curtain. But I think also the average documentary or moviegoer would like to sneak a peek about, you know what, how would they make those sounds? And this might be right up their alley. But yeah. It's, you know, it's not, if you don't care, well, right. Then, you know.
Exactly. I think it's more for cinephiles and people who really like how is that made type of
How things work. That's a very famous book. How things work.
Yeah, and so this is a little bit of the how things work peek behind the curtain.
All right. Well, that is this week's episode.
One more thing.
Guess
what's coming up on Sunday, Charlie? There's something on television this Sunday.
Oh, I think you're actually coming over for my Oscar party.
I think I am. And so just a quick note, do we make any predictions that we can then touch base on next week?
Well, let's do very quickly. Let's just do the big ones.
Okay.
The big ones. Supporting actors, I think Allison Janney has it locked.
I think Allison Janney has it locked, but I would love if Laurie Metcalf got it.
Supporting actor, I think Sam Rockwell has it locked.
I think Sam Rockwell has it locked, and I'd be okay with that.
Best actor, I think Gary Oldman has it locked.
I think Gary Oldman has it locked. Wouldn't be my choice, but he's got it locked.
Best actress.
That's a tough one.
No, Frances McDormand has it locked.
Yes, Frances McDormand has it locked. She should win.
Now, Best Picture, I think, might be the most of the big categories, the most wide open. My money is on Shape of Water.
My money is on Shape of Water. My heart is on Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Now, my heart is mostly different on all these categories. My heart's also on Three Billboards. I actually wouldn't be shocked if it won. There was some recent controversy with Guillermo del Toro and how much inspiration he used to previous things to make Shape of Water. But I think, I don't know, that could be part of campaigning, what have you. I think Shape of Water will win as well. And if you're doing Oscar pools out there, you'd be a safe bet to put that down.
I know, but I still, that's my biggest, if I had to pick one shocker, or not shocker, but underdog win, that would be it, is I would love to see Three Billboards beat Shape of Water. I just think it's the better film.
I agree.
All right.
All right, quick recap. Red Sparrow, yeah, I'm in the minority. I can't believe the amount of people who just don't like this movie.
I think you're just going to have to sort of figure that people who are a Jennifer Lawrence fan and who just saw Mother and liked it too will actually maybe be okay with this movie. But it just doesn't hold much appeal.
Death Wish. Not only is it a case of bad timing, it's just not good.
Exactly. I agree.
Bombshell, the Hedy Lamarr story. I'm glad I know something about her now. I really haven't. Maybe on Turner Classic Movies, if they do a Hedy Lamarr night, I'll DVR a couple.
There you go. It does. I learned something, so that's a good thing.
Actors of Sound. I also learned about all about the art and science of Foley. If my kid wants to grow up and become a Foley artist, I won't mock him. Go ahead.
You will forever watch movies in a completely different way if you see this documentary.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.